Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the life and times of labor leader Harry Bridges, who is a longshore worker in San Francisco, led a general strike in San Francisco in 1934, had authorities come after him, and for two decades tried to deport him. It's a fascinating and important story. And joining me here in the studio to have that conversation is Peter Afrasiabi. Peter Afrasiabi is an attorney, and he is the author of a book that's being turned into a motion picture. It's called Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. Peter Afrasiabi, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I think we're broadcasting in Berkeley, San Francisco. Many people, but not everyone, know who Harry Bridges was. But we're also, our show's syndicated and we're aired throughout the country, so we may have many listeners who aren't as familiar with Harry Bridges. So tell me, he's Australian.
Yes, he's an Australian man who was born at the turn of the last century, was in love with the sea, and came from a sort of middle-class Australian family. He had some uncles who were great heroes of his, folks who'd gone off to fight in the Boer Wars of the time in South Africa, and who were appalled at, you know, the sort of the improper nature of the war, and, you know, essentially threw down their rifles and refused to participate in the horrors of that war. And so those were sort of some of his heroes as a young boy in Australia. He loved the sea, and as a teenager,
his dad didn't want him going to the sea.
Not at all, no. The father wanted him to live your standard upper middle class life as an Australian sort of real estate manager and you know, run school and go through that kind of traditional route. But Harry loved the sea, and he had...
Well, tell me that story about...
Oh, you bet.
Didn't his father have him go on some ship that he knew was going to be a perilous journey?
Exactly, yes. So Harry came to his dad and said, I want to go to sea. And the dad, in order to, you know, convince his son, no, you don't want to go to sea, went and spoke to some captain of a ship and told him, take him out, go on a voyage, but let's go through some really rough waters at a bad time, and that'll scare the heck out of him, and then he'll never want to be, you know, a sailor. And it was rough indeed. It was so rough, in fact, that, you know, everyone went overboard, and Harry was then floating in the ocean and survived and was plucked out of the water and came back to shore, and that, if anything, had caused him to want to go to sea even more. He loved it.
Wow. I mean, that would be something that would get most people out of it. I mean, that's scary.
He was a person of adventure, a person who loved the adventure of the sea, loved the adventure of the calling of life, and, you know, was adventurous in that sense.
Born in 1901?
Yes, and so he became a sailor as a teenager, traveled that part of the world, and then as he got a little bit older, got on a ship and came to the United States, to the port at San Francisco, and this is around 1920 or so. He's a teenager, and he's a sailor. He arrives here. He was appalled at his treatment on the ship, in part because of some labor issues that arose on the ship. There was a holiday while he was on the ship, and, you know, the workers on the ship were not given any rest or break, and he felt that was wrong, and he led a sort of a mini crusade on the ship to no avail. So he essentially landed in America, checked off the ship, paid his, you know, head tax entrance due, came into the United States, and then eventually found work on other ships who were ported out of the United States, and traveled the West Coast, and then also traveled the Gulf of Mexico, and, you know, was involved in some early strikes in Louisiana in the 1920s then as a sailor at the time. And eventually settled back in San Francisco, was married, had young children, and as many sailors of the time and of today do, also when sailing becomes part of their past, longshoring becomes a natural next step. And so this sort of brought him into San Francisco proper as now a grounded longshoreman on the West Coast, where he then began, you know, working in the teams that worked at the time, offloading all the cargo and the tonnage that was flowing through the West Coast of the United States through San Francisco.
Tell me the conditions for longshore workers, and what does it mean, this term that I learned from your book? What's it? Shape up?
The shape up, yes.
What is the shape up?
Sure. So the working conditions were horrendous. It was analogized to sort of a quasi-slave market almost, in the sense that the practice in San Francisco of this shape up was a practice that actually the British had literally outlawed decades before in England. It's so appalling. And basically what happened is men would show up on the waterfront to try to work on a given day, and the people in control of the work would decide who gets to work and who doesn't.
So it's not like you had employees.
No employees.
My job. I go there, I know what I'm going to do today.
Nope. No employees, no job, no union. No real union was in existence because it had been broken. And so the result was men literally begged for work and were forced to do all sorts of terrible things to try to get a day's work to earn some money. They had to pay bribery and kickback to the person in control of the work. And so it was called a shape-up, sort of reflective of the fact that they were there to sort of go through this shape-up process to see, you know, who would win that day's work. And so that was part of the working conditions for longshoremen on the Embarcadero. And for Harry Bridges, it was particularly difficult because he wasn't a citizen. And so when he sort of had union problems and refused to participate in the sham union that was then created to control the men, it was not a real union, but it was sort of blessed, quote unquote, as a union, but men were forced to then pay dues and have their name in a book. And he refused to participate because it was part of the abhorrent, you know, system in the process that denied medical care for treatment and denied Social Security and sort of minimum wage and all the stuff that we take for granted today that just simply wasn't present. He refused to participate, and so he would be blacklisted from the system. And so those are sort of some of the aspects of it. The other component to this is that the conditions were so brutal that when men were injured, they would literally be blacklisted and denied future work. There's one famous story about a man who had, you know, several hundred pounds of cargo fall on his foot and break his foot, and he was deemed to have soft bones and so was denied the ability to work again. And if people filed any sorts of legal claims to trigger the legal system to try to get help, that would trigger blacklisting for them and for witnesses who came forward to say what happened. So it created a sort of cloak of terror on the West Coast for the longshoremen and allowed them to be abused by the ship owners and the employers association that controlled the controlled labor.
And then in 1934, there are a series of strikes, including a big strike, including a general strike. And it wouldn't be the last year there were strikes. We'll talk about that too. But what's significant to know about 1934, where you just do have a lot of activity?
Sure. So 1934, we're in the Great Depression. We have some national labor laws that have now been enacted, and things are really bad on the West Coast for the longshoremen. And efforts are afoot to create a union again. But the people in charge of this sort of effort to create a real union are still in the pocket of the ship owners. And Harry Bridges came from a very practical, pragmatic background. He was social policy conscious. He was very progressive in his labor beliefs because at that time Australia was far ahead of the United States and had adopted many progressive labor policies that we simply hadn't adopted here in the United States. And so Harry Bridges, as a longshoreman, just a guy on the dock with his team of folks, started talking loudly about the need to have a real union and, you know, spoke about his ideas and spoke defiantly against the sellout folks who were trying to create another union that would be in league with the ship owners. And as he spoke, men just started listening. I mean, he had a voice that was strong and provocative and spoke to people's hearts and seemed also very, very practical in terms mm-hmm. of the cause he was demanding and the arguments he was making. And men started listening to him. And so he started actually gaining prominence on the waterfront as just being, you know, that guy that everyone should listen to. And pretty soon, the group of people coalesced around him and they'd get together in meetings in a place called Albion Hall, which was just a hall. It was literally named Albion Hall. But they became known as the Albion Hall Group. And it was a very small splinter group, just getting together for regular meetings every Sunday to talk about what they could do to improve conditions. And it got bigger and bigger, and it reached the point that there was enough support in this faction that he started saying, no, we shouldn't do a deal. We need to be willing to have a proper strike and shut down all West Coast ports and all West Coast shipping so that we can have our demands met. And
is this putting him at odds with the quote-unquote sanctioned union?
Yeah, so he's now at odds with, certainly with the ship owners and the employers association on the other side of the table, but he's at odds with the folks ostensibly on his side of the table who didn't want to have a massive strike, who wanted to do a deal. But he refused, and they tried to do a deal, and he stood up and said no and ultimately demanded a strike be called, and the men of the union followed him and called for a strike. And so he eventually triggered this strike in 1934 that shut down shipping eventually on the entire West Coast. It started in San Francisco, but it spread to the other ports. And one of his big agenda items was the need to have a coastwide union, because the ship owners would simply, if men in Oakland would go on strike, they would say, great, you strike all you want, you're fired, we'll just offload. Here. Yeah, we'll offload in San Francisco and et cetera, up and down the coast. And so that was one of the things that he managed to start in process, was getting all of the ports to join. When the strike began, he's now running a strike. He's day-to-day managerial operations of a strike, and all sorts of intrigue, you know, that's all in the book is detailed. But, you know, the employers' associations tried to put spies into his union.
Yeah.
They tried to have people come and say, hey, here are some grenades, let's attack the police, and to provoke more violence, to which he refused to participate in. And he was a sort of great chess player in terms of recognizing we got to be careful how far we push and where we push, and we don't go too far and lose the support of the people. But, you know, this goes on for a while, and it's, you know, the police and the mayor of San Francisco decide, we're not going to show these people any quarter. We're going to call in strike breakers. And literally the strike breakers, actually many of them were like UCLA football team players. It's remarkable. I'm from USC and UCLA and some other schools. Those are some of the strike breakers.
Those are tough guys.
Tough
guys. They didn't wear helmets back then.
No.
Or at least not with face masks.
Sorry. No helmets, no face masks.
Yeah.
So they are brought in, and this is what really provokes this is sort of the spark that lights the whole fire. The men go down to the Embarcadero to stop them, and the police open fire on the protesting longshoremen. And longshoremen are running. You know, they've just been there peacefully protesting, trying to stop the strikebreakers getting in. And some men are killed. A couple men are killed. And this is July 1934, and hundreds are
July
injured.
5th. July 5th, am I right on that?
No,
this
is a little before. Oh. So we're on July the 3rd. And so some men are killed, and hundreds of men are shot in the back. And there's a lot of injuries to the back, as you know, which is really significant, because you're dealing with fleeing people being shot by the armed forces in the back while fleeing. And so the union then sort of helps the men, but this in essence becomes a catalyst, because at that point, when other unions in the other sectors of the economy saw what was going on, they said, enough is enough. We're not going to allow this. And so you then have, you know, I'm sorry, yeah, July 5th. You then have Independence Day. You have these events occurring. And then Harry Bridges leads a funeral protest of the fallen men through San Francisco. And, you know, the reports range from 15,000 to 50,000 people were in this funeral procession as it went to bury the fallen longshoremen. And that became very, very clear at that point that public support was not going to tolerate, you know, this kind of abuse. And so other unions from other sectors of the economy join, and you now have a general strike for a few days. And so quite literally, it's remarkable. You read the ancient documents, but San Francisco literally shut down. I mean, gas stations were out of gas. Cars were left in the street because they ran out of gas.
So the incident in which you have the police attacking the strikers, that's known as Bloody Thursday.
That became known as Bloody Thursday.
Yeah.
When the men were shot and killed, and hundreds were injured. And so Bloody Thursday became the sort of focal point and the catalyst then for the strike to become ultimately successful, because at that point the federal government got involved, and they were really fearful that this was going to spin completely out of control. The National Guard was brought in to bring a forced peace on the docks, and the federal government came in and essentially forced a resolution before a federal mediation board. And ultimately, after negotiations and whatnot through the legal process, with Harry Bridges sort of running those negotiations in effect, ultimately, a real union was born. And what Harry Bridges got for the men, and what the longshoremen got at the time, was everything that they had been fighting for that they were never able to get from the sellout union. They got nearly all the money they wanted in terms of the hourly wage. They got the beginnings of a proper system for medical care, Social Security, disability, these types of issues for workers. And they got a coastwide contract and a coastwide union, so that the games that were played before couldn't be played. And so now what comes out of this is a real union on the West Coast. Harry Bridges is now gone from being a longshoreman talking to being president of this union.
This is the ILWU.
Yeah, it's what became the ILWU today, which is still alive and strong on the West Coast. And so Harry Bridges now is a prominent figure who has at the same time provoked a lot of animosity in the halls of Washington, D.C., and in the financial circles on the West Coast. And so immediately
he's a threat.
And so again, we're in the Great Depression. There's massive social anxiety already about, you know, there's a Red Scare, the communism fear, and the ism of the time was communism and all that anxiety. And so immediately the narrative that is pressed is that Harry Bridges is a member of the Communist Party. Because at that time, under American immigration law, if you were a non-citizen and you were a member of the Communist Party, you could be deported. And so the immigration system was something that the government could use to deport agitators or people who they don't want here, people whose speech perhaps they don't like, and put them through deportation proceedings because of their ideology. And the requirement, though, was that you be a member of the Communist Party. And so they cast around and they said, oh, he's a Marxist, he's left, and he certainly was very, very progressive, and you could even probably label him Marxist in his beliefs at some level. But the law required he be a member of the Communist Party, and there was no evidence that he was. Federal government did an investigation, couldn't find any evidence that he was. And so you have this fascinating group that's formed, both public and private officials out of, you alluded to it earlier, Portland and the Pacific Northwest. You have some police and some prosecutors in the state of Oregon, oddly enough, because Harry Bridges had nothing to do with Oregon, really. But they were very fearful of Harry Bridges. You have some federal INS officials on the West Coast who were working with them against, you know, the executives in D.C. who they reported to. And you had the American Legion, this sort of private enterprise.
In San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
Yeah.
All working together to find evidence that he was a member of the Communist Party. And when they couldn't find evidence that he was a member of the Communist Party, they literally created it and fabricated it. And that lit a match that then began this 20-year odyssey of deportation trials as the government tried to prove that he indeed was a member of the Communist Party.
We are in conversation about the lifetimes and persecution of Harry Bridges, a labor icon from the 1930s and on. He actually had a very long life. He died in 1990. We'll talk more about that. And we are speaking to Peter Afrasiabi. He is the author of the book, Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. Peter Afrasiabi, there's some things I want to flesh out here and go into some of those things you already laid out. But first, I want to go back to the general strike in San Francisco. This was, I want to make sure I'm getting my dates correct here as well. Was that July 16th? So this is, you know, a little over a week from what was called Bloody Thursday.
Correct.
And describe to me more about what happened on a general strike in the city.
So the city ground to a halt. There were
All unions are getting in on this. Were there unions at this? Were there other?
There were other unions. You had the AFL. You had other unions and other sectors of the economy dealing with, you know, the transportation of goods and products in society. And there were more developed unions covering all sorts of other areas. And so the result of a general strike was that literally the city shut down. I mean, there was no one to deliver gas to gas stations. There was no one to deliver food to restaurants. And so the reports from the time are that there were literally only two restaurants open in San Francisco during the general strike, which was short in duration. But nonetheless, it was to show a sign of solidarity among all the union men that they had to stand together and not allow this. And so cars would run idle in the street when they ran out of gas. There was no gasoline. Like I said, restaurants were shut. And so this sort of massive fear took root that if something isn't done to solve this situation, we're going to have a massive problem. And that was sort of what enabled the federal government to get involved and start using the national labor laws that had been passed. And Secretary Frances Perkins, the first female cabinet member in American history, who was the Secretary of Labor, she even came out to the West Coast at the time. It was the first time she met Harry Bridges. And to sort of start this process of trying to find a resolution to allow city life to get back to normal.
Yeah, and then 12 years later, you'd have another general strike in Oakland, which I think was headed by textile and garment workers. And that was the last general strike we've had in this country. Made illegal after that, I think Taft-Hartley Act. Tell me, all right, so let's talk about Frances Perkins, because this is a fascinating dynamic between her, historic figure, herself, a really important member of FDR's cabinet, and Harry Bridges. And I want to know how this all fits in, because we're talking about 1934 here. This is, now you have, and I don't know exactly when the new union protections or laws for labor come out of the New Deal, you would think maybe Harry Bridges and the FDR administration may have a common thread here, but they don't. They're actually, they turn into adversaries.
They do. And so what happens is Francis Perkins, you're now, you know, he's running the union. He's become successful, but he's also become the victim of sort of a desire to try to paint him as a member of the Communist Party. And so Francis Perkins starts an investigation and can't find any evidence that he's a member of the Communist Party. And so she declines to issue a deportation warrant. That provoked the anxiety I talked about. Eventually, some fake evidence is created. A membership card appears out of thin air that in the name of Harry Dorgan, and Dorgan was his mother's maiden name. Mm. And so they said, aha, this is an official membership card of the Communist Party. He's using his mother's maiden name. And we have all these other witnesses who say they saw him at Communist Party meetings and events. And so they insisted that she begin deportation proceedings. And she declined, saying the evidence looks very suspicious and thin. We don't even think it's real. You know, this is the findings of her and her department back in Washington, D.C. And so she declines. Meanwhile, a very important case comes down in out of Texas, which had held a Polish immigrant who had been a member of the Communist Party temporarily for, you know, months or something, maybe 15 years earlier in his life before he understood what it was and had quit, was ordered deported because of that temporary membership. And the Texas court said that was really an outrageous affront to his civil liberties and you can't deport him. And the U.S. Supreme Court then took up the case. And so there were a lot of these communist deportation trials going on, these ideological deportation trials at the time. But that decision out of Texas, the federal court there, really threw into limbo, can you deport people or not? And so this case goes up to the Supreme Court. And so Francis Perkins says, there's nothing I can do about Harry Bridges right now. The Supreme Court's got to look at this. And this provokes massive resistance against her. You have all of the American Legion, you have the anti, you know, New Deal folks in the Congress.
And who is the American Legion? I mean, this is San Francisco based, so that was interesting to me. I never heard of the American Legion before.
Sure, you know, the American Legion was an organization, and it's still around today, but it's very, very different today, I think, to the way it was back then. But it was an organization of veterans, primarily of veterans, and it was focused in the 1930s on the philosophy of Americanism. I mean, it simply wanted America to be for, in essence, Americans, for white Americans, descendants of Valley Forge and all that, and, you know, was built around that premise. And so it was very active in trying to rid the country of those who it felt were dissidents. And so it actually had its own private subversive activities commission with this incredibly elaborate network of what are, in effect, spies, right? People ratting on everyone in society and sending all this information up to this sort of pre-computer index they had that was incredibly complex and complicated and was being run out of San Francisco by a guy named Harper Knowles running this commission out of the American Legion. And they were sort of out gathering evidence on all sorts of people to try to get them deported. And so the American Legion and the Republicans in the Senate and the House, but particularly in the Senate, increase the rhetoric against Frances Perkins for her defiance and her unwillingness to deport Harry Bridges and for those actions. And so they actually begin impeachment proceedings against her for high crimes and misdemeanors.
Wow.
Claiming that she had failed to do what the Constitution demanded to deport Harry Bridges because she was deferring any prosecution pending the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. And so it's really an incredible side story, sort of the persecution of Francis Perkins, who was ultimately in charge of the persecution of Harry Bridges. And the two of them are stuck in this sort of fighting ring together, you know. And there's an incredible picture in the book that comes from the Library of Congress of Francis Perkins sitting during her impeachment proceedings, you know, defiantly defending herself. And she and Harry Bridges were so similar. It's really fascinating. Defiant, strong people, unwilling to bend to wrong, only willing to follow the pole star of what's right. And in this photograph, there's Frances Perkins sitting at the table defending herself. And on this, you know, sitting up above her on the high table, right, the bench, it's just a gaggle of men, you know, scouring down on her. And part of course, the persecution against her was because of her gender.
Is that a congressional hearing?
Yeah, this was during the impeachment proceeding in front of the Senate, where she had to go defend herself. And so The Supreme Court then issued its decision that allowed the communist deportation proceedings to continue. And the public sentiment was so profound at this point that Xi really had no choice within the administration, given this quote-unquote evidence that was stuck before them, to then say, fine, we'll issue a deportation warrant, we'll have a trial, we'll see where the chips fall. And so this begins the first trial, which is set out here in San Francisco at Angel Island, which was sort of the Ellis Island of the West Coast. It had seen...
Kind of, yeah. Not as inviting.
Hardly as inviting.
From Asia,
nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, it's known as the Ellis Island of the West Coast, but it was not the kind version of the Statue of Liberty that we like to imagine, you know, Ellis Island was. It was the place that housed many Chinese under the Chinese Exclusion Act of the time for significant periods of time just being held. And it's an amazing place to go see, actually, as a footnote for any of your listeners. But this is the site of the first trial. And actually, what's a fascinating footnote to history is Harry Bridges' first trial there becomes the first public immigration trial in history. And this is because he was a well-known figure. He was sort of a popular, you know, San Francisco guy at this point. Yeah. He was well-known, and this was a big cause, and the press was clamoring to see the trial. So they opened it up to the public, and the press was there. And so every day they would ride out on the ferry to Angel Island for a day of trial. And so this becomes a multi-month proceeding out there, and it's a stunning sort of story of the beginning of the devolution of due process, because you have the government prosecutors working with, you know, the American Legion, working with other state prosecutors out of Oregon, literally putting on false evidence. You know, they tried to get into evidence this communist this communist membership card. They put other witnesses on who profess to have seen him at meetings, which never occurred. It's then proven. They have other witnesses come on the witness stand who
Who's they?
The government prosecutors were folks out of Washington, D.C., who were sent out to try the case. They were working within the Immigration Naturalization Service. And so, and you also then had witnesses who were prosecutors in the state, but they weren't the actual prosecutors of Harry Bridges, who participated. And these were police chiefs from Portland, Oregon, who had been out trying to come up with evidence that Harry Bridges was a member of the Communist Party. And in one incredible piece of testimony, you have a man named Shapiro, who had been a labor lawyer at one point early in his career, actually. And he became a labor lawyer representing a rival union of Harry Bridges, and got on the witness stand and testified that Harry Bridges was a member of the Communist Party and that he and Harry Bridges had talked about it, and really was a very important witness for the government prosecution, for these prosecutors to prove that Bridges was in fact a member of the Communist Party. And he finishes his testimony, and the cross-examination is like something out of a movie, and you read these ancient transcripts. It's amazing just to hold the paper and you just right. You read it. It's incredible. Some of the first questions to him are, you know, they show him an indictment. You know, are you the Aaron Shapiro that was indicted here in New York? Yes. For bomb making? Yes. For trying to conspire to blow up public places? Yes. Was Al Capone one of the defendants? Yes. Your co-defendant? Yes. I mean, this incredible stuff comes out on cross-examination showing that he had been himself then ultimately disbarred as a lawyer from the federal courts of New York by a federal judge who was shocked that he had not only engaged in that behavior, but then had engaged in jury tampering. And so this was the type of witness that then the government prosecutors were putting on the stand. They arrest their case, and then Harry Bridges puts on his case, and you know, some of the early witnesses put on are convicted murderers in San Quentin. And these are folks who have been convicted of murder, and they're not the types of folks you would normally think are the witnesses that you want to rest your case on, right? But Harry Bridges, you know, forces the trial to move to this prison to take their testimony. And these folks explain that a federal prosecutor and a state prosecutor came and visited them and actually offered to get them pardoned from their crimes if they would point Harry Bridges out as a member of the Communist Party.
Huh. Were they members themselves of the Communist Party?
They were. They were citizens, and they had every right to be. Mm-hmm. And so they were promised that I can get you out of this if you know, finger Harry Bridges as a member of the Communist Party. And it's some really profound testimony where these convicted murderers who, you know, who are on the witness stand break down in tears and as they recount the pressure put on them to frame Harry Bridges and how they ultimately refused to do it. One of them explaining that he'd done a lot of things in his life, although not including murder, it turned out, because he'd been framed for murder himself. But he'd done a lot of things, seen a lot of places, and really he felt, you know, sitting in prison, all he had left was the most basic part of his human dignity, his
dignity.
Word. Yeah. I mean, it's all he had left. And so he refused, and he broke down in tears on the witness stand, and they had to take a pause in the proceedings. I mean, it's really profound stuff. So that begins Harry Bridges' case, and he goes through all his witnesses. And this all then lands in the hands of the dean of the Harvard Law School, who was the trial examiner. He was, you know, seen as a respected, learned man, expected to become one of the next Supreme Court justices, was neutral and balanced. He's a dean of the Harvard Law School, after all. And so he then decides the case and, you know, ends up issuing a 150-page, you know, single-spaced decision. We're now in late 1939, where he not only finds that Harry Bridges is not a member of the Communist Party, but he finds that there really has been a vast, in effect, conspiracy of this public-private partnership of different people from Oregon, from D.C., from San Francisco, from the American Legion, putting on literally false evidence and manufactured, fabricated evidence to frame him. And so he orders the deportation warrant to be discharged so that Harry Bridges can become a citizen. And that then provokes cries in Washington, D.C. And the cries went up, actually, that Dean Landis had done a misjustice and, you know, had broken the law within a day or two of his decision even being issued. And so you had folks in Congress getting up saying, you know, calling for an immediate deportation of Harry Bridges, notwithstanding the law, and we got to get rid of him because the Landis decision was wrong. And one of the remarkable facts, that if you think about it here, is that his decision wasn't issued until sort of, I think it was December 28th or 29th of 1939. And 2 days later, congressmen are railing against how fabricated the decision is. But I don't even think back then they could have read the decision. It takes more than two days probably to read it.
They certainly didn't get it on the internet.
They didn't get it on the internet or on the wires. I mean, it takes them to read it today with all the footnotes and the staggering detail in it. So that provokes, though, massive congressional animosity. And you have Congress now really up in arms, in the House of Representatives in particular. And proceedings then start in the House to quite literally have a bill of attainder, an unconstitutional bill of attainder passed to order the immediate removal of Harry Bridges from the United States of America, notwithstanding the law, notwithstanding any decision of Dean Landis, of the courts, just literally remove him. And the congressional hearings are really acidic. You suddenly get congressmen saying things like, you know, we need to send Harry Bridges off to the British Commonwealth. They can put him on the front lines in the fight against the Nazis, let him get killed, you know, by the Nazis. You know, America is for the descendants of Valley Forge. It's not for these foreigners. I mean, all this kind of rhetoric, and it's all quoted in the book, is spilling out in Congress.
Is it bipartisan?
It does become bipartisan. Yeah, no, it's bipartisan. I mean, you have myriad Democrats joining, not universal, but it became heavily bipartisan in this sort of fear-laden environment, this sort of he was public enemy number one, and it was very dangerous to stand on Harry Bridges' side. It's really fascinating. Even the congressman who said, this is unconstitutional, we have to give this man due process and have a hearing, you can't just deport someone. Even when they said that, they always made clear to say in their public statements, I can't stand communists, it's terrible, it's evil, we have to get rid of them, but we do need to have due process here. I mean, even they were very, very constrained in what they could say. Harry Bridges actually sent a letter to one of the congressmen in New York to demand that this letter be read into the record in this hearing that's now unfolding in the Congress, and suddenly objections go up, and then they refuse to let his own defense be read in this deportation hearing occurring without him even present in front of the Congress. And eventually it gets read into the record, and it just points out the abusive nature of what had happened in the trial. But nonetheless, the House of Representatives passes – it's 330-42, I think was the number – overwhelmingly passes an immediate deportation of Harry Bridges' order. And at the same time, they actually – even in this bill that passes, they pass that he does not have the right to file a habeas corpus petition in federal court to even seek redress. I mean, it's really one of the most remarkably unconstitutional bills you can imagine coming out of the House.
Again, we are in conversation with Peter Afrasiabi. He is an attorney, and he's the author of the book that we are in conversation about called Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. It is being turned into a major motion picture. I'm very much forward to seeing that now. I mean, this is an amazing story. So the House of Representatives passed that motion. The Senate, does it take it up?
No. What happens is this really provokes a crisis in the Congress because it's an unconstitutional bill of attainder, and the Attorney General recognizes it as such. If it shows up in the Senate, it was not likely the Senate would also pass it. But if it did, FDR would have had to have veto it and would have vetoed it is the belief. But it was an election year, and Harry Bridges is a very unpopular person. And so the attorney
was unpopular.
Harry
Bridges. Most people had a negative view of him because he was painted as being a communist.
Exactly. He's painted as being a member of the Communist Party who's agitating against the status quo in the United States and is part of this leftist revolution that could be afoot, maybe supported by the Russians to overthrow American democracy. And so, he was...
Was he a revolutionary?
He was not a revolutionary.
Did it go beyond a strong union?
No, it didn't really go beyond it. It didn't go beyond a strong union. He always wanted to work within the confines of the American legal system and the dictates of our system. So he was never involved in politics at that high a level that he sought some grand overthrow of the American government to have a new system. In fact, as he testified repeatedly, those types of issues he thought were for theorists, for academics, and were things, as he would say, way above my pay grade. I'm just a working guy trying to solve practical problems like how do I have my men feed their kids? Mm-hmm. Things mundane like that he would talk about. And so, he certainly wanted to achieve major change and have major, change occur in American society, but he wasn't doing it through some nefarious sort of means like that, but that was what he was painted into at the time because of this fear laden environment. And so the compromise then is set by the Attorney General, who says, hey, look, let's do something different. We will amend the immigration laws to get around double jeopardy so we can re-deport him in a new trial. And the senators and the congressmen all say that's fine, but they wanted more. And they said, if we're going to have a new trial, we need to get the INS away from Francis Perkins. And this is a very, very important event in our history, really, because the desire to get...
INS is old school for ICE.
Exactly.
What we would say today. Yeah, that's the immigration agency.
Yeah, what we call ICE or DHS today, the Department of Homeland Security that manages all immigration today. But this name change today goes back to what happened in 1941 with Harry Bridges, because they didn't trust the Secretary of Labor and the Department of Labor to run immigration proceedings. And the Department of Labor had always dealt with immigration because immigration was seen as predominantly a labor issue in society.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so that's why the Department of Labor managed it. But Congress said, no, we need to amend the law and pass a new immigration statute that allow us to go after Bridges again and make the law more restrictive. But also, the immigration department needs to be moved to the Department of Justice. And that was something then that FDR and the Attorney General agreed to. And so they reorganized government in this executive order, and they shifted the department there. And everyone was on board with that, everyone being all the congressmen, and they voted for it. And for some of them, that had to be done to even get the vote. And so now this is a seismic shift, really, because now you have immigration policy being looked at through a very different prism. The Department of Justice deals with crime and safety,
right.
National safety, right? And so now they are charged with immigration.
Security. Yeah.
And they have the FBI within them to help do whatever they want to do. And this was J. Edgar's FBI at the time. And the Attorney General also then said that this time he would appoint a judge who would be, effectively more friendly than the dean of the Harvard Law School had been. And so the Attorney General has this new immigration law, has it now the Immigration Department and the Department of Justice. J. Edgar Hoover comes out to the West Coast himself personally to launch a new investigation into Harry Bridges to dig up new quote-unquote evidence. And this proceeding begins, and then the Attorney General appoints a friend of his who had been a New York appellate judge to be the trial examiner of trial number two. And so they set trial number two on very, very short notice, and government prosecutors now start up again. They put on a whole roster of witnesses, all new witnesses. It's really fascinating. A whole set of new witnesses, making all sorts of new claims. And Harry Bridges' lawyers do a really effective job of destroying all these witnesses, too, and showing them to be perjurers. But the trial examiner, this judge, ultimately decides that even this judge who's been handpicked says a lot of these people are lying, and so I'm not going to trust them, he gives credit to the testimony of two, one of whom admitted to a perjurer himself, gives credit to their sort of third-hand hearsay testimony and says, yep, Harry Bridges is a member of the Communist Party, and so we're deporting him. So now Bridges is ordered deported. He appeals to the Immigration Appellate Board, which by a vote of 5-0 says this is terrible. I mean, this isn't even evidence by any American yardstick. We can't sanction this. And so they undo it. But the Attorney General then steps in, which is incredibly rare because the Attorney General is the prosecutor ultimately, right? He steps in and actually reverses the Appellate Board and reinstates it. And so Harry Bridges now is forced to go to the federal courts to seek relief. And this begins his odyssey through the courts. And this becomes a very sort of important strand of his story because now you have this battle between the executive for control of the immigration system and the judicial branch, the supposed co-equal branch of government, having to fight, you know, or not fight as the case may be, for supremacy over what the law should be here. And so Harry Bridges starts...
Almost sounds like Guantanamo Bay in some ways.
It sort of is because... Yeah. It really tests the judiciary's willingness to stand up to the executive and their resolve to stand up to the executive as a co-equal branch of government. But that's something that doesn't always happen, as the Harry Bridges story shows us, because the lower federal courts really fall into line with the executive. And even though they look at the evidence and they say they don't think the evidence is very good and wouldn't really justify a conviction in a normal court, they nonetheless defer.
Yeah.
Using these institutionalized doctrines of deference and whatnot. And they just defer and they allow him to be deported, even though they don't think the evidence is very good.
But the Supreme Court did not.
Exactly. It's remarkable. So the Supreme Court takes his case and it's his last hope, really. And it's a miracle to get the Supreme Court to take any case. They take his case and they hear the case and he wins by one vote. And the Supreme Court really is appalled at the executive branch's behavior. And it's got an opinion written that by Justice Murphy, who also wrote the famed Korematsu dissent when...
Japanese internment.
The internment in our domestic camps of Japanese Americans during World War II. He wrote a very passionate dissent to that at the time. He wrote, you know, some of the most moving words you can read in constitutional opinions about the collapse of due process and how this case really stands, he said, as a testament to man's intolerance of man. And he wrote those words. He couldn't have been that prescient, but what he thought was a case of a crusade that he labeled it, and one of unbelievable denial of due process and, you know, intolerance of people because of their beliefs. He wrote those words only halfway through the saga. But nonetheless, he wrote those words and issued this wrath of constitutional condemnation against government officials, including the Attorney General, who was present in court that day, and Justice Murphy glared at him as he read these words. And so you'd think by all accounts that, you know, hearing that and now seeing this fantastic example of our separation of powers, where the judicial branch has called the executive on lawless behavior and said, no, stop, you can't do that. You would think that the executive would be chastened and would stop.
That'd be the end of the story.
End of story.
But it's not.
No, my book would have been half as thick if we had stopped there. So what happened then is Harry Bridges swears in as a citizen. He's now finally authorized to swear in. But there's this quirk to American law. When you swear in as a citizen, you have to swear that you're not a member of the Communist Party. And so he swears. I swear under penalty of perjury of the laws of the United States. I'm not a member. And two of his buddies, who were just union guys who came down to be witnesses at the ceremony, you know, swear as witnesses saying, yep, I know him. He's a good guy. He's not a member of the Communist Party. And they give these affidavits for him, too. He becomes a citizen and he goes on with his life running his union. And we're now, you know, in the 1940s, late 1940s. Meanwhile, the FBI is out doing more investigations and conjuring up more witnesses. And eventually a grand jury is convened and a special prosecutor from Washington, D.C. is brought out to San Francisco, and a whole new roster of witnesses are put before the grand jury. And the grand jury says, yes, let's indict Harry Bridges and his friends for conspiracy to defraud the United States government into issuing citizenship papers, because when he swore under penalty of perjury that he wasn't a member of the Communist Party, he lied, because he's really always been one. And if it sounds circular, it really is.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there was some old law on the books that they dusted off, and so they used that to then start a criminal prosecution. So now the government prosecutors have really raised the stakes, and the policymakers in D.C., because now they're saying, not only do we want to deport Harry Bridges, we want to put you in federal prison.
They want to revoke his citizenship?
To revoke his citizenship, deport him, but put him in federal prison. And to get leverage over him, they went after his friends. So his friends were now, you know, co-conspirators, you know, co-indicted co-conspirators with Harry Bridges before a federal court jury in San Francisco. And so this case then goes to trial. And this really is the most, in some ways, the most exciting case of all, because you've got famed local lawyer Vince Hallinan, who is a real trial slugger of a lawyer and a really well-known San Franciscan. You know, his kids have became, you know, I think one of his sons became the mayor of San Francisco at some point.
And his kids are also very close to this radio station.
Yes.
Yeah, even former board members.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, the Hallinans.
I mean, sort of
and friends.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, so Hallinan was sort of just a trial slugger of a lawyer. He represents Harry Bridges in this trial, and you know, there are fireworks out of the gate between Hallinan and the judge. And they had a long history where the judge, before he'd become a federal judge, had really pressured Hallinan to not pursue a breach of contract case against someone that owed Hallinan money, and had tried to use his state judicial power to sway Hallinan, who refused. Hallinan won his case. And so they were sort of sworn enemies. But the judge didn't recuse himself. And so they immediately start butting heads in the trial, and it's explosive. And Hallinan challenges the judge's supremacy, and literally on the third day of trial, after fighting with the judge because the judge wouldn't let Hallinan explain to the jury his defense theory, the judge walks out onto the bench and holds Hallinan in contempt of court and orders him not only disbarred but also jailed for 6 months. And so the court pandemonium erupts in the courtroom. You know, the marshals descend upon Hallinan. Hallinan's holding onto the podium, refuses to leave, and is arguing with the judge. And in all of this, no one's really thinking about Harry Bridges, who's a defendant fighting for his life, his American life, who's losing his lawyer now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, after this raucous day of events, eventually the judge turns to Harry Bridges and says, "What do you think?" And Bridges, being such an intelligent chessman, says, "Well, if you take away my lawyer, if I lose here, I'll never think I got a fair shake. But you do what you have to do, Judge." And so the judge retreats to his chambers and comes back and says, "Okay, fine, I'll let you keep Hallinan for the trial."
Wow.
"But nonetheless, you're going to jail, Hallinan," he tells him. And so the trial proceeds, and it's, you know, again, a third set of witnesses now, all different, you know, coming up with fantastical stories, putting Harry Bridges at Communist Party events, you know, 15 years earlier, and some amazing stuff with Vince Hallinan pulling out newspapers to when he's cross-examining these witnesses, and the witnesses are swearing that they were in New York with Harry Bridges on, you know, July the 1st, and Hallinan shows newspaper after newspaper with Harry Bridges speaking at some public event in San Francisco on July 1st. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And nonetheless, the whole case goes on to the jury, and the jury convicts. And, you know, I really found some incredible records in the lawyers' archives from the investigators, you know, queries of the jurors afterwards. And the jurors were engaged in improper behavior from the beginning. They were talking about the case when they shouldn't. And some of them, you know, talked about how they were told by friends, "Yeah, you just got to make sure you get that Harry Bridges." And so there's this sort of environment. I mean, we're now in 1950, the height of the Red Scare, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're on the eve of McCarthy and all that. And so Harry Bridges now is convicted, and his friends are convicted, and they're now staring at federal prison terms. Hallinan, meanwhile, is shipped off to Puget Sound to serve his six-month sentence. And they manage to maintain bail for Harry Bridges, which is fantastic for him. But then he speaks against the looming Korean War, and quite literally the same judge imprisons him.
And here it all goes again.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Here it all goes again for his speech.
Peter Afrasiabi, we have what we call in radio the tyranny of the clock. We're actually up against the end of our time. But I do want to ask you quickly, because I just can't leave it there. When does it end for him? When does this persecution end?
The persecution ends in the mid-50s after that whole history in the Supreme Court hearing the case again, and then another trial and a whole set of new incredible, you know, drama, and then hearings before Congress where they try to get him again. But it eventually ends in the 1950s, as we have now, the Red Scare, you know, peaked and crested, and we were sort of past it. And Harry Bridges then, you know, went off into the sunset, so to speak, and ran his union up until he retired in the late 70s, you know, maintaining and running this union on the West Coast, which still exists today.
Today.
Yeah.
Good job,
sort of this
today.
Incredible success story.
Did he ever reflect on what all that was about?
Yeah, he's incredibly humble as a man. I mean, he saw it as, you know, using him as a means to get at men and to get at union. So, you know, for him, he always would talk about how I was just the person they chose to target, but this was about the men on the waterfront. My men, my union, and our right to have basic human rights and basic living standard. And so he always saw himself as being, in some ways, a footnote to his own story. He was a really humble guy in that sense. And one of the remarkable, you know, twists to his whole story is in his later years, he is retired, this sort of once man who was inimical to American democracy that threatened our way of life. Federal executive officials invited him out to Washington, D.C. to actually speak about labor policy to the government.
Of course.
Many decades later. I mean, it's really remarkable. But he becomes this sort of success story as this defiant hero who refused to buckle, notwithstanding all the pressure put on him, and refused to demand due process, to refuse to be silenced, you know, demanded that due process be respected, wouldn't silence his voice against his persecutors, and just stood firm for what he believed in, and ultimately prevailed.
Peter Afrasiabi has been our guest. Again, he is the author of the book Burning Bridges, America's 20-Year Crusade to Deport Labor Leader Harry Bridges. It is going to be turned into a major motion picture. Peter Afrasiabi, that's an incredible story. Thank you for telling it.
My pleasure. Thank you.